Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that thinks discretion might not always be the better part of valour. My name is Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
In this episode, we're going to ramble on about a few different issues. We're going to talk about coronavirus, we're going to talk about stock markets, and we're going to talk about civil servants, all of which are about the vague theme of secrecy. How are governments responding when they're given information that they don't want to hear? So if we talk about the coronavirus first, or to give it its proper name, COVID-19, at the time of recording this, COVID-19 isn't a pandemic?
Not officially.
Not officially. So we're going to talk about a few different countries. First one we're going to talk about is China. The response from China to COVID-19 has been quite fascinating, hasn't it, Steve?
I mean, yeah, it's kind of played into their normal way they respond to these sorts of threats and outbreaks of illnesses. So if you think back, listeners, to pretty much every single kind of health scare type, you know, disease or virus or whatever that's been around in recent years, SARS, swine flu, bird flu, pretty much all of them at least have some kind of footing or emerged from China. The reason is just by the basic fact of just China's just like the ideal place for these things to develop, both in terms of like temperature, climate, and as well as kind of like the way that society is structured, and the combination of rural living in close proximity to animals so that they can make the jump over to different from animals to people, and then also very densely populated cities where things can kind of just shoot out in all directions. China has got quite a history of having to deal with these sorts of issues, and COVID-19 has continued with their trend of trying to keep things secret, trying to make sure that no information gets out because it's a sign of weakness, I guess. And they've been continually trying to kind of like stamp out whistleblowers as best they can, to the extent where I think one of the doctors who was a whistleblower over COVID-19 died. There's now conspiracy theories that he might have been killed by the Chinese government.
Well, I thought he died of COVID-19.
That is probably what did happen, but the conspiracy is.
Well, and we should always believe conspiracy theories.
Of course, I read it on Twitter.
So, yeah, it was Li Wenliang who was a Chinese doctor, first warned about COVID-19 back in December, who has now died. I think died 2 or 3 months later.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the response is interesting because you've got the very secretive, totalitarian, all-controlling nature of China, and that is suppressing information. So you've got that, you've got delaying informing the world about the disease as well. So I think officially the disease is not meant to have been starting until December, but there's reports in The Lancet that suggest it might even have started back in October, and yet nothing was talked about.
Yeah.
The other side of that, that kind of overblown authoritarianism, also means they've also got a lot of stuff done very quickly. So they were building hospitals in days. China shut down 16 cities and quarantined 50 million people. And when they were looking at, when they knew, say, Steve got COVID-19 and he's on a train carriage, the Chinese government were using their surveillance state and the big data to monitor and work out who the other people would have been on that train carriage with you to find them and check them and see if they've got the disease as well.
Yeah.
So it's a real weird mix of
authoritarian, totalitarianist hell, but for arguably a good purpose.
I don't think the people who admire China because it can get stuff done and then forget the fact it's a dictatorship. And I suppose the thing is, both of those go hand in hand. Like,
yeah, the reason they can quarantine millions of people in cities is because they're prepared to actually shoot the people that leave.
And the thing with the censorship as well, and the firewall, is that they are just crushing dissent, which is why they stay in power.
Yep.
But then also, it loses their ability to hear problems. And this is a thing with dictatorial regimes, is they don't want to hear problems. Thing in terms of China then is, it's all about keeping public order. So Xi Jinping has made it clear in some of his speeches that actually he reckons public anger would lead to social instability. So it's very clear that this is all about keeping control.
Yeah.
And the Chinese Communist Party in particular keeping control.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's always, when it comes to any form of, I don't even want to say just dictatorial or dictatorships, I want to go with like authoritarian as kind of like the descriptor, where that focus on control in one way or another is kind of the guiding light when it comes to these kind of emergencies and crises. I think I'm probably jumping ahead a little bit, but you can kind of see it to a degree actually with Trump's reaction to COVID-19 as well. Although he's kind of gone into the opposite direction, the Chinese have gone, we will control this, we will do everything we need to get done. Trump has gone in the opposite direction, which is, I can't control this, therefore it can't be a problem. And then has kind of moved into the land of make-believe and delusion with how to handle it. We're just going to put Mike Pence in charge, it will be fine. We've cut all the budgets, but, you know, it will be fine. You know, because it's not really an issue. You know, this is another kind of like a conspiracy brought up by the Democrats to try and bring me down.
I mean, I suppose the interesting thing is, how much of that does Trump actually believe? But before we talk about Trump in more detail, the other example is Iran. In Iran, 77 people have died, and that's the most in a country outside China. And, I mean, interestingly, what the experts believe or suggest is, officially Iran has 2,300 people at the time of recording affected with the COVID-19. But the experts suggest, well, actually, if 77 people have died, it's probably more like 4,000 have been infected. There's a significant underreporting there from what we can gather.
Yeah, I mean, this really is just a case of basic mathematics. As of today, I believe the WHO announced that the death rate is something like 3.6%. For COVID-19.
That's really high.
Yeah, it's very high. So it really is just a basic case of, well, we know there's 77 people who've died that they've admitted to, at least. From there, we can work the math backwards to get to that figure.
So there is a New York Times article which talks about Iran and the coronavirus outbreak. So it talks about, I'm just going to quote directly from the article because it's quite astonishing. So in northern Iran's Golestan, apologies for the pronunciation, province, where Iran has acknowledged about two dozen infections. The top health official railed in a news conference on Sunday about his frustration with Tehran's refusal to acknowledge the extent of the epidemic, then quotes him as saying, this health official, "We were screaming at the health ministry that we have 594 corona patients, but the ministry was telling us, since you don't have positive test results, we won't give you the equipment you need." The official, Dr. Abdulreza Fazil, complained. They kept saying, wait, 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 and then suddenly they announced you're an epicentre. We've known from day one we're an epicentre. Which is astounding, really.
Yeah.
It's very sort of Kafkaesque, isn't it, and circular, like Catch-22. We don't have any... We've got these people, we need to test them. Well, it's fine. We're not going to give you the test equipment because... you haven't got it.
Yeah.
But then also, doctors, nurses have been told by Iranian security officials to keep quiet because some have been told by the state security that sharing information about COVID-19 is a threat to national security and will be swiftly dealt with. And health officials have been apparently have been slow to give tests and resources to people.
Yeah. It's I just don't understand the logic of a lot of the responses to this sort of thing. I don't understand why, what the negatives are to not respond properly.
Well, I suppose, so in terms of Iran, I mean, Iran is a country that's had civilian protests much more, I'd have thought, in terms of high profile ones than China in living memory, with student protests and stuff. Also, their economy's been hit very hard. So China's is still relatively booming, relatively, I suppose, and that it's been, well, or rather, it's been growing relatively well. Iran's hasn't, because US sanctions have crippled their economy. You've also got a military situation, which since the assassination of Soleimani isn't that great either. So there's lots of different instabilities there already. Plus, when you factor in the fact that I believe there's about 20-odd members of parliament that are now been tested positive for COVID-19. You've got one of the advisors to the Supreme Leader, I believe, who was hospitalised this week.
But this is kind of my point. Like, yeah, you've got all of those instabilities, so why would you add another one on top of it of, like, you know, failing to act to deal with this crisis?
You try and keep the genie in the bottle.
But that's not how the world works.
Well, no, but well, this is the thing, isn't it? So I suppose the problem is, I mean, it's a similar situation that happened with Chernobyl, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is because often an authoritarian society, by its very nature, is closed. There's an information gap that's there. And so it's very similar, in fact, probably I might have made this point on the podcast before, to a medieval monarchy. You don't, that monarchs don't really want to be told bad news. So no one actually bothers giving them correct information. Democracies are meant to be different. So actually a leader in a democracy wants to be told about the bad thing.
So they can fix it.
Yeah, exactly. Because that way you build public support and you can manage that crisis. Whereas if you are used to not having a free press, you don't need to worry about that sort of crisis management aspect to it. And which is why generally open societies are better at dealing with this kind of thing, because it's the light being the best disinfectant, generally. But then that's turning its head, as you've kind of suggested with the American example, because Trump is someone who has got very authoritarian instincts. And as you say, if he can't control it, is quite happy just to dismiss it and say it's not happening, which is really, really irresponsible. I mean, the other thing that Trump did was say that Xi Jinping and China's response has been very, very efficient, in that kind of random praise he gives before slapping the tariff on, which is just not true.
As I basically said like earlier, like Trump's response is kind of like a classic authoritarian's response to this. And it is only by virtue of the fact that America, at least in terms of how it's set up at least, is still, as you say, an open society and is kind of, in theory at least, able to respond in a way that isn't entirely based on the whims of whoever's in charge. Although Trump and Pence are making a damn good stab at trying to make it that case when it comes to COVID-19.
I suppose you've also got the cuts aspect of it as well, because so in terms of information you don't want to hear, getting rid of government officials who might not give you the information you want to hear as well, or I think in Trump's case he just doesn't believe that government is worth it and doesn't do a good job. So for instance, Trump shut down Predict, which was the American federal government's research centre into predicting where pandemics might strike, might be useful. There were 47 pandemic centres run by the US around the world, which would help countries research, support, look into these kind of stuff.
They're gone now, I'm guessing.
37 of them are gone, those 47. And also, there was a pandemic response chain of command which was responsible for coordinating the American government's response to pandemics, and that all got axed as well. That was set up by Obama to deal with Ebola. Trump got rid of that as well. So you've kind of got the two, you've got the kind of turbo neoliberalism, if I can use that phrase, on the one hand, and you've got Trump's wannabe authoritarians on the other.
Yeah, it's a perfect storm potentially for the US for failing to deal with this outbreak, which could have wide repercussions on obviously people's lives, the election, the economy.
Well, and this is why Trump is worried, right? Because he thinks that his re-election is predicated on the economy, and he's taken all the credit for the stock market increasing when it was actually going up under Obama. And so now, if it starts to tilt, he doesn't look good, which is why he's now encouraging people to say coronavirus is a hoax, or he's getting, is it Larry Kudlow, I think, to go on the Bloomberg News or wherever it is and say everything is fine.
Yeah, it's proper like comical Ali, Last Fall of Baghdad stuff at points.
The firing of civil servants was sort of meant to lead us on to Priti Patel, but I suppose we've got there through a little bit of a
detour.
A little bit. I mean, it's probably, this podcast will go out probably a couple of weeks since Philip Ruttman put out a pretty amazing statement talking about Priti Patel's treatment of him, of other people in her department. More allegations have come out since.
Yeah, I think three different people from three different departments in government that Priti Patel has worked in have basically come out and effectively backed up Philip Ruttman's allegations that she is effectively a bully in the workplace. Yeah, so it doesn't look good for Priti Patel.
And I think there is an inquiry underway now, so we'll wait for that to come out. Obviously, Priti Patel cursed by me picking her as a mover and shaker in 2020. I suppose she is moving and shaking.
Yeah, just not in a way you might have wanted.
We talked in the podcast a couple of weeks ago about the civil service, about the blob, as Dominic Cummings calls them, of that, the kind of Sir Humphrey types who maybe want to steer government policy one way or another. And so maybe this is why Priti Patel's getting a little bit of resistance. And this is what the Tory MPs and right-wing press have basically said, is that civil servants are just the lefty snowflakes who can't cope with a woman telling them what to do. Problem, I think, is why doesn't... I don't think that quite works in this instance. Yes, there's obviously a culture amongst Whitehall of trying to obstruct some things. However, the other thing with Yes Minister is Humphrey Appleby was always proud of telling Bernard that he would implement policies he disagreed with as well. So I think there's more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, if the civil service didn't implement policies that it didn't agree with, then there'd be an awful lot fewer policies implemented in one way or another. So it's clear that that's not the case.
And John Redwood actually wrote an interesting article on Con Home about the ways in which you can try and circumvent the bureaucratic machine. So, and that tended to be obstruction, like they wouldn't put up a policy paper. So Redwood's got this idea, and you know the idea has to go to Thatcher to make a final decision. He's got his idea. The civil service would be slow coming up with their alternative. So Redwood says, well, we'll just put my idea through to Thatcher and you won't be able to have an alternative to go up against it. And that was a pretty good way of activating the machine. Like, you almost need someone...
Yeah, it's an ultimatum.
Yeah, you need someone who's going to drive the policy through. Yeah. The problem, I think, with a lot of what is happening at the moment, particularly in the Home Office, and particularly in relation to Brexit, as Chris Gray's talked about on his blog, is a lot of the stuff that the Tories are trying to do in relation to Brexit is not possible to achieve. So we haven't even talked about Brexit yet, really, this year, Steve. I know you must be
heartbroken.
But there's the fact that the government is trying to get the EU to go around. It's trying to find a way to go around that oven-ready deal that Boris Johnson struck up with the EU to try and find checks in the Irish Sea.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, fascinating on one sense that, you know, this deal was meant to be great and now they're trying to find a way to get out of it. But then the other thing is, well, they're trying to deliver frictionless trade while leaving the single market and customs union, which isn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. And they're also talking about trying to get a Canada deal with the EU when the EU has said that Britain is different to Canada, so it can't have a Canada deal, which is why Brexit has kept talking about Canada +++, because there was this thinking that it had to be different to Canada by its very nature. And any civil servant that has tried to push against this line, whether it be Ivan Rogers, Philip Ruttman, are ending up leaving because the advice they're giving is not wanting by government. So there's a difference between being obstructionist but actually giving impartial advice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is going to be one of those interesting situations where Philip Ruttman has basically said he's going to take the government to court for a constructive dismissal, effectively, because he feels like the attitude of the government, and Priti Patel in particular, meant that they were effectively trying to get him to quit anyway. So it's, you know, it all falls under kind of like legal situations. If there's going to be a court case, then papers, policies, statements will almost certainly end up coming public, and we'll get to see exactly how much the government on certain key issues is battling against reality.
Yeah, and I feel like, again, it's a government which is fighting too many wars on too many fronts, really.
Absolutely.
And this is one they could really do with not having.
But again, like they've kind of put themselves into this position by getting rid of people who might have actually been competent in the role, as much as we might disagree with them. Like, you could have had some competent people kind of like doing Priti Patel's job, but because Priti Patel is ideologically pure, for lack of a better way of putting it, she's been given the role, even though, you know, we know for a fact that she's not suited for these sorts of positions because she ran a shadow foreign operation.
Yeah, it sounds like she will stay because number 10 thinks she's got the right credentials on free movement.
Yeah.
And hang them and flog them.
The issue comes if more and more things come out, does her position become untenable? And it may very well go down that route if she is as bad as it seems she is to work with, then there's going to be more.
What do you think of, if we just finish off with this, the British government's response, though, to COVID-19? It started off a bit funny with Boris Johnson not really taking charge.
Yeah.
But now everyone's back on the Today programme. It's like old times.
Yeah. I think what's quite interesting is we've been discussing the reaction to the government and civil service kind of butting heads. With COVID-19, Johnson and I think Dominic Cummings as well have actually been listening to the experts and listening to the civil service, because the civil service servants in this instance are scientists. And they've both got this slight fetishization of scientists as a whole. And as a result, the chief medical officer and the chief scientist for the government, whose names I've completely slipped my mind. I was reading up on them earlier today, but they've come out, they've done their press conference, they've briefed the media and everything, stood next to Boris Johnson, going through everything in as kind of like a cool, calm, collected tone, addressing questions, saying, no, this is what's likely to happen. Yeah, that could happen, but in reality, the rate's going to be lower than that, you know, all of that sort of thing. Be doing a very good job of setting expectations, but also being upfront about the risks. And it's quite interesting when you see some of Johnson's responses to questions at the same time, is he very much adopts the same kind of tone. Like, there's a thing where in psychology, people adopt the kind of like the characteristics of their leaders in, or whoever is leading them in that situation. And it is quite clear that in this situation, Boris Johnson is not in charge. It is very much these two scientists who are driving the show. And that is a good thing. And it does show a distinct amount of maturity, actually, at least in this one instance, from the government. But it is fascinating to see that these, you know, we were supposed to have had enough of experts, and yet, when it comes down to it, the government's prepared.
Well, social scientists, obviously, we can take or leave, but actual, you know, scientists with science are fine. If you want to hear more of Steve praising Boris Johnson...
It doesn't happen very often.
You could go to our Patreon page, couldn't you, Steve?
You could indeed go to our Patreon page, where you'll find access to unique content available only to our patrons. Available only to our patrons. This includes podcast episodes, blog content. There's some discussions going on there. Yeah, it's all good stuff. Everything and any money we make from the Patreon goes towards running the podcast, getting us equipment, paying our hosting costs, all of those lovely, lovely things that allow us to continue making the content that you're enjoying.
Thank you to everyone who is supporting us so far, even Phil Wallace. We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. Dave Depper composed our theme tune. Our Twitter is @nochampagnepod. I'm @paperbackrioter.
I'm @acousticradical.
Happy plotting.